Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On day one of Joe Biden's presidency, he issued a barrage of executive orders that some have described as shock and awe. And he immediately set out to undo some of Donald Trump's most notorious immigration policies. The Muslim ban or travel ban was overturned. Biden wanted to halt construction on the border wall and to fortify DACA after Trump had tried and failed to scrap it entirely. But those are the headline policies. The Trump administration spent 4 years quite deliberately and subtly rewriting America's entire immigration system, and Biden can't undo it all with just the stroke of a pen.
My name is Sarah Stillman, and I've been covering immigration along with other topics for The New Yorker for almost a decade now. Back in 2018, I set out with a team at Columbia Journalism School to follow the vast array of changes to immigration policy happening during the Trump era, and especially the evisceration of the asylum system.
Sarah says there are upwards of 1,000 changes to immigration rules and processes, bureaucratic, technocratic measures that might seem small, but taken together, they've had profound consequences.
I wanted to see how these changes were playing out in real people's lives, and that led me to a mother-daughter pair. I'm going to call them Gabriela and Maria.
Did you leave Honduras?
Señora, ¿en qué fecha salió usted de Honduras? September 4th.
They came from Honduras. Gabriela worked for a powerful political party in her seaside town, which caused her to run afoul of local gangs. Eventually, she denounced that party, which endangered her life. Her husband told members of the party to leave the family alone, and not long after that, he stepped out one morning for his morning cigar, and he was shot to death by assassins in a car. Another older daughter had been kidnapped and sexually assaulted by organized crime, and the family was just consistently being stalked. And so that daughter and Gabriela and Maria realized that there really was not a way for them to be safe where they lived. They tried relocating internally, and then ultimately they concluded that they had to flee north to the United States. And so that's what they did. The family's experiences are horrifying, and I want to say that what follows from their court testimony is upsetting to hear. But sadly, that part is unexceptional. I've heard so many painful stories from this region of Central America over the last decade of people fleeing violence.
To the respondents, good afternoon.
Buenas tardes, ma'am. Good afternoon.
I'm Immigration Judge Shelley Scholes at the Adjudication Center in Fort Worth, Texas. The court is appearing via video teleconference, as are the respondents and government counsel.
What really stood out to me about their case was how clearly the judge communicated to them about these new Trump-era policies. And in the audio from the immigration court, you can hear the judge spell out all of the traps in asylum policy. She was new to the immigration system, which I think was part of it. And I followed a lot of families' asylum cases, and you rarely get to see or hear in a single case an authority figure spell out policy after policy after policy, the ways the Trump administration closed the door on protection.
We're here for continued removal proceedings. The respondents are present and appearing without counsel today. The government is represented by Ms. Sherry Hurley. We are here today to take additional evidence on your applications for relief.
Gabriela is appearing in this hearing with only her younger daughter, Maria, who is 14 years old. When they'd arrived at the border, the family was split up, and Gabriela's older daughter, who's the one who had been kidnapped and sexually assaulted back in Honduras, she was detained and then swiftly deported. And meanwhile, Gabriela and Maria separately were sent to wait for their asylum hearing in a program of the Trump era called the Migrant Protection Protocols. This was something the administration had instituted after family separations when a lot of people, frankly, stopped paying close attention. And suddenly the Trump administration created this policy that was pretty drastic, blocking asylum seekers from waiting for their hearings in safety in the United States. And the language is quite Orwellian, migrant protection protocols, because instead of protecting asylum seekers, what this program actually did was force them back into Mexico, into some of the most dangerous cities in the world to await their hearings. And so up until now, Gabriela and Maria have been waiting in the Migrant Protection Protocol's camp in Matamoros, Mexico, where they've been sleeping on the ground on a piece of cardboard. And now they were showing up to their asylum hearing alone, without an attorney, because the government doesn't provide legal representation and most asylum seekers can't afford lawyers. The government has even argued that literally three-year-olds should be sent to represent themselves alone in immigration court and to answer a judge's questions about why they deserve protection.
Go ahead and tell me why you left.
Because we were receiving threats. They killed my daughter's father. They abducted my daughter. She was raped. The intention was to kill her because she had overheard about some drugs that were going to be trafficked. During the time that she was abducted, there was an agent of the police therein.
All right, ma'am, let me explain something to you before we go any further. The United States has a law that states if you entered the United States through the southern border on or after July 16th, 2019, and if you traveled through other countries outside of your home country, and if you did not request asylum or other protection in those countries, then you are not eligible for asylum in the United States. Now, I will continue to ask you questions about why you left Honduras and why you are afraid to return, so that I can determine if you're eligible for any other kind of protection. But I want to make it clear to you that you and your daughter are not eligible for asylum because of U.S. law. Do you understand what I've told you so far?
¿Entiende usted lo que le he dicho hasta ahora? Yes.
You can hear that immediately Gabriela and Maria were disqualified from asylum because of this new Trump policy, sometimes called the Third Country Transit Asylum Bar, which said essentially that if you pass through any other purportedly safe country on your way to get to the U.S. to claim asylum, that you're no longer eligible, that you basically forfeited your chance because you could have been safe elsewhere and you're now not going to get to be safe here. This is a moment to point out the basis of asylum law. After World War II, countries got together and decided that we would never again allow people to be turned back to countries where they would face potential death or persecution. And so we created this international system to ensure that that would be the case. But this family's finding out that simply because they walked through other countries on their way to try to get to safety, they no longer have the chance of it. And now one of their only ways to stay safe in the United States would be to qualify for protection under something known as the Convention Against Torture, or CAT, C-A-T. It's really hard to meet this bar, partly because during the Trump era, they went to great lengths to narrow the definition of what qualifies as torture. And you can hear the government's lawyer spell out these onerous requirements.
And you're just looking through some of the case law. You know, for an applicant to qualify for protection under CAT, specific grounds must establish or must exist that indicate that the individual will be personally at risk. Eligibility for CAT relief cannot be established by stringing together a series of suppositions to show that torture is more likely than not to occur.
It's always been the case that in order to receive asylum, you have to prove that you were persecuted as a result of very specific things about your identity, like your religion or your political opinion. What's unique here is that under the Trump administration, these qualifications just kept getting narrower, and so did a lot of judges' interpretations of them. So in claims for legal protection, for instance, you're supposed to show that the state had been unwilling or unable to protect you. And now that's just more difficult to do. And I think what's especially hard for Gabriela and Maria here is that even though one of their family members had been actively assassinated and another one of them had been sexually assaulted in the presence of a Honduran police officer, they themselves had not been physically harmed. The law does not require that. It does not require physical injury to win asylum. But some judges act as though it does. And now, in this case, this judge is trying to figure out if Gabrielle and Maria might qualify for protection under her interpretations of what are increasingly narrow definitions.
Have you ever been personally threatened with harm? And I'm talking about you specifically.
A mí no.
Not to me, no.
A mí no me dijeron. Siempre fueron contra mi hija que...
It wasn't to me, it was always true to my daughter.
Yo puedo hacer con ella lo que yo quiero. Y le enseñaba la foto.
She said, no, your sisters can still wait and your mom can still wait. And then he pulled out a picture and said, look, and it was a picture of us.
Ella me decía a mi hija, mami, nos van a matar a todos, mami, nos van a matar a todos, mami, eso repetía.
She just kept repeating, mom, mommy, they're gonna kill us, they're gonna kill us all, they're gonna kill us all, she would repeat.
So the testimony here may sound a little bit confusing, but what Gabriela says is that the men who had assaulted her older teenage daughter had also shown the girl a photo of Gabriela and Maria and threatened their lives. But the issue for the judge is that they hadn't been told that directly. The threats had been made to the sister who was being held captive.
All right. Do you have any reason to believe that your family was targeted because of your race or nationality?
No,
I don't know why. I don't know why.
Do you have any reason to believe you were targeted because of your religion?
No creo.
I don't think so.
This is a very difficult case. I'm going to ask the government counsel for her input on what protection, if any, you qualify for.
So at this point, the judge mutes Gabriela and Maria and their translator, and she turns to speak directly to the government's lawyer. You can hear that the judge is new. She's a Trump appointee, and she's just diving into this case law. And so she talks it through out loud.
All right, Ms. Hurley.
Your Honor, we would...
Let me tell you what I'm thinking, and then I want your input.
Yes, ma'am.
I've already established that they are not eligible for asylum based on their date of entry. However, I am considering whether they qualify for withholding of removal under CAT because of the presence of a uniformed officer at the scene where the sexual assault and other harm took place, and I certainly think that kind of conduct rises to the level of torture. What's the government's position?
Your Honor, I believe our position would be a lot of the respondent's testimony seems to be a lot of speculation as to what happened and why it happened and who may or may not have been there. I don't know that there's enough information before the court to establish, you know, if this person's in some form of a police uniform, where they're from or, you know, what agency they're even from.
Well, that's an easy question to ask. And I certainly can ask her if we're talking about a Honduran police officer. Go ahead, though. Continue.
And I think that to me, there's a lot of speculation. The fact that one individual is dressed as an officer doesn't necessarily mean that they were an officer. You know, I don't believe that the testimony that's before the court is enough to make it more likely than not that if these respondents were returned, that they would be tortured. I don't believe that the testimony that's before the court is enough to establish that there's been sufficient state action.
Let me explain what's going on here. It makes a really big difference in these kinds of cases what role the government played in a family's persecution. And this is especially true in the Trump era because Trump appointed a ton of new judges to the Board of Immigration Appeals, and that board had decided that they would raise the bar for determining when an abusive cop was simply acting as a rogue officer, a bad apple, essentially, and when his persecution really rose to the level of state action. The government here is trying to argue that this is just, you know, one bad apple. Maybe he's just a regular dude wearing a police officer's uniform. And so the judge needs to figure out, in this case, what was the role of the police officer.
Ma'am, with regard to this police officer that was there when your daughter was kidnapped, was she able to see a name or give any identifying information about him?
Ella estaba estirada en la cama. Ahí la tenían estirada en la cama.
She was stretched out on a bed.
Ellos estaban en una esquina del cuarto.
They were on a corner of the room.
Y vio a ese policía ahí.
And she saw that police officer over there.
Él no le pudo ver una placa o algo porque él estaba en la de espalda de ella.
She couldn't see a name tag or anything because he had his back facing her.
Right, but what kind of officer uniform was he wearing? Like what town, what country?
Honduras.
It was Honduran.
Eran pantalones submarinos.
It was a navy blue pants.
This is a very difficult case, and I'm trying to do the best I can to follow the law of the United States. Yes. Do you know if this police officer was present when your daughter was actually kidnapped on the streets?
No.
I don't know. I did not ask her that.
Do you know if this police officer was involved in sexually assaulting your daughter personally?
He was watching as she was being raped. Him along with other men.
Do you know if this police officer ever touched your daughter himself?
No, he only watched.
All right, ma'am, I do appreciate you answering those questions, and I appreciate your being honest with me.
That part makes me so furious. Because you hear the profound arbitrariness of who's going to get protection and who is not. Whether a police officer was sitting beside a teenage girl while she was raped or whether he was actively physically using his body to do the raping, that's the absolute fulcrum on which this case winds up turning. And that, to me, feels really troubling. And is an exact example of how the Trump era, through these things that seem very small and very technical, the minutiae of immigration policy can really create the distinction between life and death for a family.
So I've considered all of the testimony and the evidence that you've given me. If there was some legal way that I could provide you protection in the United States, I certainly would try to do so. However, based on the evidence that I have, I simply cannot offer you any protection under the law. I want to talk to you about why. First, although you have certainly experienced some traumatic events, neither you nor your daughter have been subjected to persecution as that's defined by law. The death of your husband and the kidnapping of your daughter are certainly serious events, and I don't mean to suggest otherwise. However, the harm did not occur to either of you. You also do not qualify for protection under the Convention Against Torture. The presence of a uniformed police officer certainly gives the court great concern as far as what happened to your daughter. But just because one police officer is acting unlawfully does not mean all of the government of Honduras or that the government of Honduras wants to harm you. For these reasons, I'm very sorry to tell you I'm denying your applications for relief. You have the right to appeal my decision if you wish. Do you want to reserve the right to appeal?
I cannot return to Honduras. Am I expected to have another one of my daughters raped or killed for me to be able to apply again?
I need you to answer my question. Do you want to appeal my...
Listening to these proceedings, you can see how narrow and stringent the law has become. This should be the definition of a strong case for asylum, but you can hear that this judge, based on the way she's interpreting the laws of the Trump era, feels that her hands are tied. It almost sounds like the judge is saying, in order to qualify for asylum, you almost have to have been murdered to show that you could be murdered. And without a lawyer present to contest that particular reading of the law, that was the bind that Gabriela and Maria were in.
Ma'am, before I let you go, I just want to tell you one more thing. I am very sorry for what has happened to your family. If the laws of the United States gave me a way to provide you protection, I would. I do wish you both the best of luck, and I hope that you can find a safe place to live. We are adjourned in your case.
Thank you.
It's never been easy to find sanctuary in the United States. And frankly, even under the Obama administration, that was not easy. But what really stood out to me in this family's case is that in every direction they turned, through minute change after minute change, the Trump administration had basically put up a wall against this family in violation of international and domestic law and essentially condemned them to being sent back into very terrible and proven danger. On Biden's very first day in office, he ended new enrollments in the migrant protection protocols. But he hasn't actually made clear what he's going to do in a very concrete way for all of the people who are still awaiting safety. And so the question for me in listening to this family and in learning their story becomes, you know, will they find a different America in Joe Biden? Will they be reunified together as a family? And will they get the protection that they deserve?
Sarah Stillman. Gabriela, as we've called her, is in hiding in Mexico, and her daughter Maria returned to the U.S. by herself to try again for asylum. She was placed in a shelter for unaccompanied children, then released to a relative during the legal process. Two groups, one called The Door in New York and Americans for Immigration Justice in Miami, are assisting in her case. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Amanda Petrusich may be a familiar voice to you. She writes about all kinds of music for The New Yorker. And she's often on our program talking about what she's listening to, what she's obsessed with. And for a few years, she's been singing the praises of a group or really a solo project called The Weather Station. Here's Amanda Petrusich.
So my first introduction to The Weather Station, fronted by the singer and songwriter Tamara Lindemann, was incredibly, I think, almost a decade ago now. I am a dedicated diehard fan of folk music in all its varied forms, but for me, a lot of contemporary iterations of the genre can feel a little precious, a little sentimental. And what I love the most about Lindemann's work is that it contained a bit of grit, a bit of toughness. I think the first time I wrote about the band, I said one of the things that I loved about them was it felt like these songs could take a punch to the face.
There was a time you put your hand on the small of my back. I was surprised that you touched me like that. But there in your hand was a current of life I could hardly stand or stay still.
The Weather Station's new record, which is called Ignorance, is an even bigger departure from that traditional folk sound. And in some ways, it still resembles the folk music that I love so much that I know has been a formative influence for her. But in other ways, it just feels like a whole other universe of sound. Thank you so much for doing this, Tamara. I'm thrilled to talk to you. I'm such a fan, and I find the new record to just be extraordinary. It's been such a gift to have during this time. So thank you for doing this.
Oh my God. Well, thank you so much. I'm really honored to do it.
This should be fun. So with each of your records, I feel like I can hear you kind of gently reinventing your sound and really rethinking all the ways in which a person can communicate through melody and rhythm and silence and language. And I think that feels especially true of Ignorance, which at least for me kind of feels like your biggest, your poppiest record to date. There's almost this sort of late 80s kind of Kate Bush vibe to certain tracks. And I haven't necessarily heard that in your work before. I'm curious if you started writing with the idea of change in mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I feel like there's always the part that I can't take credit for because it was just, you know, intuition. But I think, it just began in like I was playing guitar and I wasn't really feeling, I felt uninspired. Like everything I played, I felt like I was repeating myself. So I switched to keyboard and that changed everything right away. And then I switched to writing with a drum machine, which changed everything. So I got pulled in that direction. But I think that this like very emotional, passionate music was the right move to convey this extremely like emotional, passionate record, and leaning into some of this pop ideas was really empowering for me because, I mean, pop is where we go for these big emotions.
You've talked about how the deepest emotional experience you had while writing this album was reading the IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees, which is a fairly dense policy report on the impact of climate change. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about what it was like for you to read that report for the first time and how that experience maybe sort of shaped or changed the direction of the album.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually read it, it's like incredibly dense and hard to understand. But, you know, the summation of it, I mean, it is, like I say, I mean, I think I had this really wild experience in 2019 when I was writing this record that a lot of people have had and people call, you know, have given names to it of just like experiencing climate grief or like experiencing, you know, you've known this your whole life and then all of a sudden you really realize and it really hits you that this is going to happen. And like, you know, hundreds of millions of people will die, you know, X amount of refugees, you know, the when you read it laid out, it's so heavy. And yeah, like I had this funny experience with this record where it's like, on the one hand, it is personal and it is emotional and there's relationships in it. But when I was writing it, what I was really truly experiencing was this experience of climate grief. And I feel like people don't, or what, I didn't feel like people would believe me that some of the songs came from that place.
So you're going to perform a song for us. It's called Robber. And I wanted to ask you, what are you writing about here? Who is being robbed and of what?
I feel like it's more like, what am I not writing about? You know, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously we live in a time when the literal future of life on Earth is in peril. And it's so difficult to hold that in your mind and to understand that, you know, there are people who are choosing to make that worse, people with a great deal of power. So I guess that's maybe what I was thinking of the most.
I know, just to sort of make it even more specific, I know you have mentioned on Twitter that you also had, you know, a company or a corporation like ExxonMobil in mind when you were writing about this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and it's something that I've been thinking a lot about the last couple of years. You know, I was born in the 80s, and, you know, I learned about climate change when I was a small child, and you know, as all of these documents have come out, and this truth of, like, ExxonMobil in particular, and several other fossil fuel companies, that they knew that they knew that this was real, that, like, their own scientists discovered it, like, before NASA did, and chose, you know, actively made a choice to create this misinformation campaign and, like, bury the science, like, for their own business model. Like, that to me is just the most insane decision in human history. And I mean, I often think of, if I was a historian looking back, you know, what would I think about the 80s when there was this choice made to do the wrong thing, you know, actively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So I have a small ensemble with me. Evan Cartwright on percussion, Karen Ng on saxophone. Okay, Evan, you want to count us in?
Never believed in the robber. I never saw nobody climb over my fence. No black bag, no gloved hand. I never believed in the robber. I figured everything he took was gone. Never believed in the robber. Hold open the gates for the wand of lust. knows the dust.
That's Tamara Lindemann of The Weather Station performing the song Robber. Her new album is called Ignorance. Stick around. We'll be back with more music in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We'll continue with staff writer Amanda Petrusich, who just spoke with the songwriter Tamara Lindemann. Lindemann records as The Weather Station, and her new record is called Ignorance.
So you didn't start out your career as a musician. You're a successful television actress during your high school years. I know you acted in some HBO dramas. How did that happen for you at such a young age?
It was all just by accident. I really loved singing. I was in a choir, and then that led me to a community theater. I met a couple other kids who had gotten agents and gotten into TV, and I was like, well, I'll try that. Why not? I just sort of fell into it when I was 13, and I really hated high school, so it was very attractive to me to not have to go to school as much, if I got a job. It was a wild ride. I mean, you know, I feel like there are ways that I'm still like recovering from being an actor. But there are ways in which, you know, I learned things from it and I gained a lot of independence from it.
What were some of those things that you feel like you're still sort of working past or still metabolizing? Some of maybe the bad things that were associated with that career that inspired you to, you know, take this left turn?
Well, you know, I think most of all, having no agency, you know, as an actor, you are a tool, for someone else's imagination, which I think is beautiful, you know, and as a band leader, for example, now I ask other people to do the same for me, to bring their talent and allow me to direct it. For me, being an actor was just strange in that I had no boundaries and, you know, people touch you all the time and move your body and you have no personal space and you're not allowed to, you know, assert your selfhood. You have to literally embody someone else. So I think for someone, you know, it's a recipe for disaster in terms of like finding your selfhood and being able to, you know, have boundaries.
Right. Especially at that age. As a teenager. Yeah. You've been pretty open on social media about how the income from your work in television, the early work in television, made it possible later on for you to kind of really establish the career in music that you wanted and to sort of stay afloat in that way. Do you think it would have been possible for you to make it to this point if you had not had those early work experiences that maybe allowed you to get a little money in your bank account?
Well, I think that's a really important question, and that's why I wanted to bring that up on social media, because I feel like people don't have a lot of knowledge about how dire the financial situation is for artists in general. And for example, for me, you know, having that underpinning of, you know, income and savings from working in TV, like, allowed me to, when I started becoming a musician, I had all this freedom that my friends didn't have because they were working, you know, debilitating jobs in bars and restaurants. And I feel like people look at artists and think like, oh, they must be making tons of money, and they're not. Like, it, you know, and it's only going to get worse, you know, if we don't figure out a way to monetize art. You know, it'll increasingly be that only artists who have like a trust fund basically can be musicians. And I don't have that, obviously, but you know, even just having that little safety net of like, I can pay my rent, you know, like I'm not gonna, you know, be homeless if this tour doesn't go well, you know, is a huge, huge safety net that a lot of artists don't have.
Well, I'm so grateful to you for being open about this, because I think, you know, any kind of talk of money, and I don't know if this maybe functions a little bit differently in Canada than it does in the US, but any talk of money is sort of considered very, I don't know, taboo or sort of, it's just ground upon which none of us should tread. And I think, you know, in the end, that protects people other than artists. And from what I understand about streaming revenue and tour economics, it seems, as you were saying, kind of borderline impossible for a new artist to really make a living if they don't have some outside income stream. And I'm curious if you've seen that kind of play out from within the industry, you know, folks who have had to maybe abandon this as a gig because it just was no longer feasible.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people I know, you know, I mean, in Canada, we do have like some grant money that does come into the system. So it's a little less insane than it is in the US. But yeah, for sure. I mean, people, once they have kids or once they, you know, need to make a better living and live less hard, it can be very difficult to be a musician. And the thing that I noticed too is like, I was like a middle of the road actor. Like I didn't, you know, I was never famous or anything. Like I was just like a middle class actor. But I made enough money to like save some money, you know, and musicians, even when they're doing so well, I mean, I know a lot of musicians who've been very successful and well known, and all that really amounts to is like 2 or 3 years of being able to pay their bills, you know, and that's kind of crazy.
And I feel like it seems especially kind of acute and urgent right now in the midst of a pandemic when so many musicians, touring musicians and their crews have been grounded. And I'm curious, with touring off the table, what is your sense of how, you know, kind of smaller emerging artists are finding ways to survive these days? Is there another path? Or is it kind of the sad reality that, you know, they're just going to have to get different jobs?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely worried. I mean, in Canada, we've had a pretty decent, you know, government benefit for during the coronavirus pandemic. So that's been really helpful to a lot of musicians I know. And actually, for some people, it's been their first downtime where they've actually had time to work on music because of this benefit, even though it's extremely meager. You know, it's not enough, but it's almost like a, you know, a good argument for basic income. But it's hard to know what the future will hold. Like, definitely I personally see little bright spots like Bandcamp getting so popular.
Maybe you could speak just a little bit about what they've been doing and sort of how they have maybe taken a more equitable or more ethical approach to, you know, kind of dividing revenue between the organization and the artists who make the music.
Well, I think just the difference is that you pay for the record on Bandcamp instead of paying for a subscription. So the money goes directly to the artist or the record label. So, you know, real money comes through rather than, you know, a subscription service. You know, touring being off the table is tough in a lot of ways, but also it levels the playing field a bit, because touring too is very expensive. And people have this like blank slate knowledge of like, oh, musicians tour to make money. It's like, have you, the budget of a tour is very, very, very challenging. You know, trying to, you know, it's very expensive. So touring too can be like musicians who are already doing well can do it. And musicians who aren't are like tapping into their savings and like going to great financial lengths to tour. So right now there's this beautiful kind of like level playing field where you can put out a record without spending so much money on a tour, which is awesome. But yeah, I don't really know. I wish I knew.
Right, an impossible question, yeah. Of course. And I think we're all, I mean, everyone who loves music is kind of waiting to see what the world looks like on the other side of this thing. You know, fingers crossed that we make it there sooner rather than later. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your writing process and your lyric writing process in particular. And I think you do it so well, which is why I wanted to sort of ask you about your tips and tricks, you know, getting the feeling or the idea to sort of exist in just a few beautiful words. I'm curious if there's lyricists or, you know, poets or novelists or other writers who you have found inspiration with.
Yeah, I mean, like everyone, I have, like, you know, I return to Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. But yeah, I feel really lucky to be surrounded in this community in Toronto and Canada in general that actually really shaped me as a lyricist. And I didn't understand that it was unique to Canada. But yeah, there's a ton of musicians like Sandra Perry, Ryan Driver, Gord Downie. Like there's this thread in Canadian music of like philosophical songwriting, Stephen Lamke. And that's how I like my lyrics to be. You know, I like them to be about ideas as well as stories. And I've been realizing lately that that's a product of my music scene, and it's not actually that common in the rest of the world. Most people want stories, they want songs that just tell a story. You know, they don't want the complicated ideas, but I do, so.
Right, and not simply just a story. I think people want autobiography. You know, I think there's this presumption that every time a singer opens her mouth, it should be, you know, it should be coming sort of directly from her immediate experience.
I do write, like, personally and honestly, but I think I've realized something in the last few years that hopefully will make the next few records I write a lot easier, which is that I never was here to just talk about my life. Like, that was never what I was trying to do. I was always trying to do something else. I was always trying to express something more complicated, because the simple songs that are just diaristic never made the record.
Yeah, very cool. So we're going to end on another track off the new album called Tried to Tell You.
Yeah, I mean, I was really just trying to write a simple song. You know, I was thinking of a friend, but then I felt like I was thinking of everyone, of just like wanting my friend and anyone to allow themselves to feel their own mystery and stop trying to pin it all down. But it's like the most pop song I've ever written, I feel like. But okay, sorry guys, you've been waiting so long. Oh, we've been talking for so long. I didn't realize. So we'll play.
I am sorry.
No, I'm great. All right.
It was getting late. You were afraid of yourself, afraid that you might call her, that you could not help yourself. And what could I say? I lived in you all day. I watched her in your eyes and pass across your face like the wind in the water. I tried to tell you that is the way that you want her. I tried to tell you. So afraid to try and pull apart the endless rain you thought of as your heart, with blood on your hands from the river inside. You try to deny it. Never felt the tide of the moon pulling closer. I tried to tell you that is the way that you want her. I tried to tell you. Like the wind in the water, I will not help you not to feel, to tell yourself wasn't real, and only fools believe. This is what the songs are for. This this is the dirt beneath the floor. I cannot sell you on your own need, but some days there might be nothing you encounter to stand behind the fragile idea that anything matters. I'll feel as useless as a tree in a city park, standing as a symbol of what we have blown apart. You know you break what you treasure. I tried to tell you, but I'm not sure you remember. So I try to tell you, and no, it cannot be measured. I tried to tell you, would it kill you to believe in your pleasure? I tried to tell you.
That's Tamara Lindemann performing Tried to Tell You. Her new album, Recording as the Weather Station, is called Ignorance. Lindemann spoke with The New Yorker's Amanda Petrusich.
That was beautiful, and thank you to your band.
Yeah, thank you.
Well. Have excellent weekends, everyone. We'll Friday.
Yeah, thank you.
We made it. All right, take care, everybody. Thank you again so much.
That's it for the show. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
We had special assistance this week from Destry Maria Sibley.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.